Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Today we will devote the hour to that oh-so-important member of the family pet. We welcome any and all questions you have about the care and feeding of the animals in your home. We will also put some special emphasis this morning on what happens when your pet develops a serious illness like a cancer. Of course, general questions are also welcome this morning about that beloved furry friend, or if there is no fur, whatever kind of hair or lack of hair your pet may have. Joining us this morning to field those questions are two guests. Both are naturally veterinarians. Dr. Laura Garrett is Clinical Associate Professor of Oncology in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois. Dr. Garrett, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. And also joining us is Dr. Brendan McKiernan. He is director of the Veterinary Teaching Hospital at the University of Illinois. Dr. McKiernan, welcome back to Focus.
Thanks, Craig.
Glad to have you with us. And we welcome you to the conversation as well with any and all questions you may have about your animal companions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can find us at Will Radio TV Online, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dr. Garrett, I asked your colleague, Dr. McKiernan, last time what drew him to veterinary medicine. I want to ask you the same question, and specifically to oncology.
Well, veterinary medicine in general, I was sort of the classic child of, from as soon as I could walk, I wanted to be a vet. I had a brief period of about a year where I decided blood might bother me, I think in seventh grade, and then went right back to it. So I loved animals and realized, fortunately, through my career that working with people is extremely important, and I really enjoy that aspect of the job as well. Oncology is an area I'm extremely happy that I'm involved in, but I sort of fell into it in a strange way, and it had more to do with the specialty program that was available in the city that I wanted to live in at the time. Mm-hmm. And now looking back, I'm very thankful that it worked out that way, because I think ultimately I would have ended here no matter where I wanted to live.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the human element, and I imagine in a specialty like oncology and dealing with pets, you're dealing with pet owners who are at sort of like a really high emotional state because they're dealing with a pet who has, you know, has developed tumors, maybe, you know, has perhaps an aggressive cancer. I mean, what is that interaction like, and how do you need to prepare yourself for that?
Yeah, it can be a very high stakes sort of environment, both emotionally and financially. And many people say, well, it must be so depressing to be an oncologist. But interestingly, most of our pets have an excellent quality of life while we're treating them. And we have the most dedicated owners, oftentimes, that are involved in the treatment. So, you know, to me, I would have a much more difficult time with shelter medicine or areas of, you know, euthanasia for behavioral disorders is something that I think would drain me over the years. Whereas with oncology, I feel like we can really improve these patients' quality of lives, get them extra time with their beloved family members, and also help them have a peaceful end at the end if it comes to that.
Do they tend to be older pets?
Yes. In general, cancer is a disease of older animals. However, there are certain cancers, just like there are in people, that affect young animals. So we will see some systemic cancers as young as 10 months of age, sometimes 1 or 2 years old is a not uncommon age for some of the dogs we see.
Dr. McKiernan, any unusual trends occurring these days in the veterinary world the last few months? Have you seen any particular cases at the hospital that are different from maybe when we spoke back in the fall?
No specific trends. I think we see the unusual cases just because we do have the number of specialists in a variety of other areas besides oncology. We had one in just recently that unfortunately suffered a traumatic bite wounds from a visiting pet owner, brought their dog, and the two dogs didn't know each other, got into a fight. This dog developed a tear in the windpipe or trachea and blew up more like a balloon. It was repaired, and the dog is doing quite well, but that was an unusual and unfortunate event of a Christmas visitation.
Hmm. Let's take some calls, and we will start with Lori in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have obviously a question for you. I have a female West Highland Terrier. She's 8 years old. I've had her for about 2 years, and she came to me with as the start of the ownership with skin issues, which, you know, we were able to remedy. But I've seen kind of a general deterioration over time. She's now on thyroid pills. After several rounds of antibiotics by my vet, who I like very much, I made the decision to stop the antibiotics. She had lost her fur. The fur is coming back. My two concerns right now are, number one, that she's very underweight. I got her when she was 16 pounds. She's now maybe around 12, maybe a little under 12. I'm feeding her raw food. She has a very good appetite, but I can't seem to put weight on her. The second issue that I'm concerned with is her walking ability has deteriorated, particularly in her hind legs. So those are my two issues right now.
Okay. I can try to talk a little bit about that. The concern that I'd have right off, well, obviously your concern is I think a 25% weight loss. That's pretty significant for any age animal. In an older animal especially, we worry about the cause for that. I'd ask you a couple questions. Bowel movements, stools, what do they look like? Are they normal?
They're very hard. She has difficulty.
Okay. But not diarrhea?
No.
Okay. The thyroid is a question, is a concern. Typically, animals or people, classically at least, that are hypothyroid that need supplementation are on the heavier side, a little bit overweight.
Right.
But not always. Thyroid's a difficult one to pin down in animals. I don't think that's behind what's going on here, what you're describing. What I would want to see is a complete panel, just as you or I went in with unknown or weight loss. They'd be doing a chemistry panel, looking at your kidneys, your liver, a urine sample, for instance, a blood count, those kinds of concerns. So a full annual evaluation, and in this case probably a little bit more as far as blood tests to look for problems.
Has she had a thyroid level checked since she's been on supplement?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's not high?
No, it was low.
No, that's a good point.
It was slightly low, and now she was rechecked, and it's now within that acceptable range.
Good. Good. Okay. The antibiotics, hypothyroidism can lead to changes in the fat content on the sebum, on the skin, and often secondary infections. But those are usually pretty obvious. They often cause a lot of irritation and itching, sometimes almost pustules or pimple-like skin changes that do respond to the antibiotics. And you didn't mention that she's really itchy. Is that the case?
Right now, no. I mean, her skin tends to be moist.
Oily feeling?
Oily feeling, yes.
Okay, and that is the sebum, the oils that come out and often have secondary bacterial infections. But most concerned about the weight change here, you definitely need to have a full evaluation, blood work. The walking, they may have some concerns and do a neurologic exam, a musculoskeletal exam,
okay,
to look for arthritis changes, to look for potentially something more serious internally with the weight loss. So radiographs or other ways to look at that. But starting with a general full exam like our annual exams, then some blood tests probably would be my suggestion.
Right. What are your thoughts on antibiotics?
They're definitely indicated, but for certain problems. You, again, didn't mention really an irritated, reddened skin, pustules, secondary infections, which would be my concern and reasons for utilizing them.
Okay.
All right. Lori, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
All right. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions today about the care and feeding of your pets, from dogs and cats to birds and gerbils and beyond. We welcome any questions you have for Dr. Laura Garrett, Clinical Associate Director of Oncology at the U of I's College of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Brendan McKiernan, Director of the Veterinary Teaching Hospital at the University of Illinois. And we welcome those questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL, or you can call us toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I guess one of the big questions that that first caller raised is really understanding when and how far you take medical treatment with your pet. That's always a big challenge, isn't it, Dr. Garrett?
I think one of the things that we try and answer is what's going on, and then to be able to present treatment options and decide which option sounds best if it's something that the pet owner would wish to pursue. So certainly in cancer, knowing what it is, not just it's a lump, but this is the kind of cancer it is, this is how it acts, this is the prognosis with treatment options, these are the costs, and now do we move forward? It's always a reasonable decision to choose not to treat, but to provide those answers so people can make educated decisions about their pet's healthcare. And it, you know, similarly with these unknown underlying conditions, it sounds like, you know, the last caller has a Westie with some weight loss that's not easily identifiable. There could be an underlying problem that's treatable, but we have to find what it is to know how do we treat it and is it something they wish to pursue.
You mentioned lumps, Laura. Probably good to point out that not all lumps are necessarily cancer.
Absolutely. Yeah, many of the lumps and bumps we see are benign tumors, so it may be in that category of very easily curable cancers or things that don't even need to be addressed, but, you know, small fatty lumps that dogs will live with no problem.
Let's go next to Linda in Champaign. Good morning, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hello. My sister had two parakeets for a couple of years, and a couple of weeks ago, one died. And the other seems to be okay, but is there anything we should be doing for the one that's still alive? She's put some mirrors in the cage and a couple more toys. But do we? Will he be okay?
Well, we're talking about parakeets, not the exact person that you'd probably want to have that answer, but pets definitely pine, if you will, or sense a loss, dogs, cats, and I would imagine the birds as well. And the mirrors would be an attempt to provide some distraction. I think that would be a good idea. The university here does have a wildlife and exotics specialty group, a number of people, and they certainly could help answer a question if you wanted to give them a call as other things. If it was an age-related problem, I don't know why your other parakeet died or the other parakeet that was passed. There might be more of a concern. Was there something environmentally present that caused a problem that led to the demise of one that you would want to then be aware of and watch out for the other? So managerial changes, dietary changes, temperature now in the winter, cooking sometimes. I know one of my small things as a Teflon pan cooking as gives off a gas that can be deadly to birds. Mm. So those kinds of concerns that someone with the expertise more aligned of avian work would be good to call. We have a couple of people, again, at the university that can deal with those questions.
But I guess another element of her question really just gets into the psychological, and this you know, applies to any pet. I know a lot of folks just go through the process of they tend to have one dog maybe that's a little older and one that's a little younger, or one cat that's a little older and one that's a little younger. And as one passes on, they go out and get another one to try and have that sort of steady companionship for the pets for each other. What are some other things that you can do for any pet in general terms?
That's interesting. Being social animals ourselves and the animals that we have as pets generally are social animals. We do expect them to show signs of loss, and the way they show it can be quite interesting. And in general, I do think that you'll see some personality changes in the remaining pet. And sometimes, according to some of my owners, it's actually an improvement, which is sort of surprising. But there was 15-year-old dog that the owner lost and had this dog's litter mate. And we were discussing at that time, you know, what is this litter mate going to do? And do you get another pet at 15? Sometimes they're not so accepting of a young animal. That's just an annoyance. And I checked in with her a few weeks later, and she said this remaining dog's personality had just blossomed, that she was sort of the underdog the whole time, and now really didn't seem to be nearly as sad as the rest of the family. In general, though, I think you do see some animals being more withdrawn when they are missing their companion. And
definitely.
Whether or not to get another dog at that time or ahead of time is, again, a lot of personal decisions, how it'll affect the whole family and not just one individual member.
It really is a question maybe of role reversal or just, you know, a new role for the given pet. It does seem as if whether they are pets within the same household or from different households, they have this innate sense, a lot of animals, it seems, to know who's the dominant dog, who's the top dog, who do I have to respect here, that kind of thing. You sort of see that in their behavior, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, can definitely.
We have an email from Carter in St. Joseph who says, we're thinking about getting a dog for our family. We like Brittany's and West Highland Terriers. Would either breed be better for two busy boys ages 3 and 8? We've heard Brittany's are pretty active. How much and what kind of exercise would you recommend?
I just had a discussion with a good friend of mine who is a behavioralist because of family friend of ours is looking at getting a dog for a family with 3 active boys. One of the things she mentioned, which I thought was quite interesting, is it's ideal to get, especially in situations with young children, sometimes it's ideal to get an adult dog. She said around the age of 3 years old, because their personality is set at that time and you can assess them and know that they are not going to be a fearful dog or a fear biter. And sort of what you see is what you get, as opposed to a puppy where you think you can help them form, but only to some extent. There's genetics at work that you don't necessarily know how that dog is going to be. So one consideration, breed aside, is looking at perhaps rescue dogs of those ages and of 3 or so, maybe of those breeds. And as far as those specific breeds, both of them are very active dogs. The Brittany being a larger dog will need sort of more room to run.
A lot more ball playing and activity like that. And if they have young boys, that probably would fit in well there. The Terriers tend to be or can be sometimes a little bit more protective and sometimes a little more of a concern as far as people coming in the house. They might be more aggressive in that regard. Not necessarily. If they are getting a young puppy, then it's important to, you don't have that established behavior to look at, but you have parents, at least the mother very often is present, then you can look at to try to select that animal that is a little bit more outgoing, that a puppy that approaches you as opposed to cowers, that the mother is also accepting and is a good pet in that regard.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we welcome your questions about the care and feeding of your animal companions. My guests are veterinarians Dr. Laura Garrett. She's a clinical associate professor of oncology in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois, and Dr. Brendan McKiernan, director of the Veterinary Teaching Hospital at the U of I. You can talk with Drs. Garrett and McKiernan at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Our Facebook page, you can find us at Will Radio TV Online. And that phone number, again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Our next email comes from Ruana, who says, one of our 2 4-year-old guinea pigs died on Christmas Day. I've heard that when 2 guinea pigs are raised together, which these were, and when one dies, the other does not usually follow far behind unless you get the remaining one a new partner because they are so social. We do not, however, want any more guinea pigs. Should we give our remaining guinea pig up to a shelter, or do you think he'll do okay? So far, he seems fine. It's been a couple of weeks, but I don't want him to suffer because we don't want any more guinea pigs. And she says, thanks in advance for any advice you can offer.
We're really hard to predict the future here. I'm not sure there's any specific reason to give this guinea pig up if the family and the guinea pig is still enjoying each other. I don't think there's a medical reason. We talked before about pining and loss, and I'm sure that in the guinea pig world that that also happens, and that might be a reason to consider a second. But if they're on the verge of giving up, then they might talk to a shelter, if there is one for guinea pigs, that they would be able to place it. I hate to say that, but that's what we were just talking about. It might be a thought that they would not, if they're not in the mood to get a second guinea pig to replace, to keep them company, then
what
might be time.
What about a play date? I mean, is that an option? You find other owners of maybe a single guinea pig and say, oh, let's see how these two relate to one another. Is that a good or bad idea?
I guess if the goal of a play date was to see if they could cohabitate, that could be a way to introduce them and see how are they going to respond to each other. But oftentimes when you are introducing animals together, you want to do it very gradually. Mm-hmm. Have their cages in the same room, then move their cages slowly together so that they get used to the presence. If it's just like, poof, another guinea pig, sometimes that can be more of a territorial. You might have an aggressive reaction. Whereas if they'd gradually become accustomed to them, they could have developed a friendship. So I don't know how well play dates work, especially in the guinea pig world. I don't know as far as the pining leading to death in guinea pigs, and that's something that also you could call and maybe leave a question with our specialists at the vet school that deal more with that. I wonder if one of the issues of losing one guinea pig and then rapidly losing another has to do more with perhaps age-related. So people tend to get guinea pigs of the same age, and then maybe when one passes away, and I'm very sorry that happened, especially at the holiday season, the other may follow suit just because of another age-related issue. I would think if you were going to lose this guinea pig with due to the loss of, due to grief, that it would start showing some signs ahead of time. So if you watch its food intake and its weight and its activity level and all that seems very good, then I would think the likelihood of a sudden passing away is much less.
Just getting back briefly to the notion you raised of sort of this territorial nature that animals tend to have, and I think we can broaden this out to, you know, dogs and cats and pretty much, you know, a lot of common animals. I have heard it suggested by other veterinarians, and I wonder if you both agree, that if you are attempting to introduce a new pet into your household, maybe the first thing to do is introduce the pets outside, out in the street, then on the lawn, then in the home. The idea being that it's starting on neutral ground and then ever slowly into more of what is a more traditional territorial domain. What do you think of that?
I definitely think that a neutral place is good because you have, this is my house, I'm going to protect it, and someone new is coming in. So just to bring him into the living room is probably not a good idea right to start. If your dog has met other dogs, if it's a dog we're talking about, walking down the street and is good, has been through some training and can approach another animal and not have any issues, then starting to do something outside, the play date maybe, supervised, or walks together on leash so that they are together to get used to each other, a gradual introduction. None of us get married on, you know, instantly. It's a gradual introduction to your soulmate, and the same thing would happen, I think, bringing another dog into the household.
Yeah, I think, I'm smiling because I'm picturing throwing indoor cats out into a street to see what they do.
So right.
It won't work for cats very well. And so for cats, what we'll oftentimes recommend is put one in a room, shut the door, and leave them in that room, the new one, sequester into a room where they can sniff under the door. And it is fun over the few days where you see them starting to sniff more and more and little feet coming out and playing with each other under the door. It's still a little bit dramatic when you open the door, but you want to be there and have them gradually do it that way. So it's for cats, unfortunately, because they do live inside, there isn't, most of the time, it isn't a very easy way to introduce them not in their own territory.
Right. Well, that's a good idea, though, separating out one room and, okay, this is the room for the new cat until...
And they get curious enough that eventually they're not angry about it. They just really want to know what's going on behind that door.
Yeah. Don't we all? Let's go next to Julie in Champaign. Julie, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering if you would recommend some resources. An elderly friend of mine and I adopted a 2-year-old male Havanese who's just been fixed, and he has fear issues. He has a history of some nipping when extremely fearful. He's afraid of almost all people, sudden sounds, sudden noises, his own shadow, et cetera, et cetera. So I was wondering if you might recommend some reading, a local professional, where to start. We've had him now a couple weeks.
I do know that, again, from my behavioralist friend, that the ASPCA has some very good online resources for training adult dogs. I don't know the website. If you look up ASPCA dog training, I believe Google will hit on those resources for you pretty quickly. And I would just urge you to even consider, you know, as you are reaching out now, to get professional help on this, because this can be a very serious problem and probably something you do want to even talk to someone, not just do some reading.
Yeah, we did get some information from our veterinarian. Unfortunately, there aren't any veterinary behaviorists who are very close by.
Mm.
We weren't too keen on heading out to Purdue. We had been hoping that there might be someone close by who we could at least start with.
You're right. There aren't any behavioral specialists in downstate Illinois. There is a woman in Tuscola, I believe, Dr. Sally Foote, who does a lot of behavioral work. She's not a behaviorist per se, but she does do behavioral work. And most veterinarians, you said you've been to your veterinarian, are familiar with these kinds of things. They don't have the specialty training or degree, if you will, of a behaviorist per se.
I would also search for dog trainers.
Right.
And you may have done that.
Okay.
As well. It's just they have their specialty in an area that may be able to really target where this is arising from.
Okay. My impression is that he was poorly socialized. He's probably a puppy mill dog. But he's come around a long way since we started. We just have to...
It's a constant work to education of him and learning and getting his confidence.
Right, right. Yep, confidence. Exactly. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Next up is Mike in Champaign. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Yeah, say we have a new adult cat that really would like to go outside. And so we've gotten a little harness and a leash. And when we put the harness on it, to me it seems kind of tight, but I'm not sure how tight it should be. And then we put him on, and he just sort of flops over and looks at us.
Mm-hmm. You've killed him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, any advice?
If you're definitely going to be outside, a harness rather than a collar, because cats are little Houdinis.
Yeah.
And would slip a collar very easily or choke on a collar,
right,
perhaps, if they're loose.
Yeah.
So the harness is a better idea. It may take some getting used to. Think of a horse. You don't put a saddle on them first time out. It'll take a while. A puppy doesn't learn to heel with a collar on for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think eventually flopping over will stop.
Okay.
And if they get hungry enough, they're going to get up and move around. But getting them accustomed, getting them used to the harness before you actually head outside, I think, is a good idea.
Okay. And how do we sort of judge how tight should it be? Because I know people have said, our cat, if it's not tight, they slip out, but then he looks uncomfortable in it. So
I would think you should be able to get a finger under all aspects of it. So I know how some of them have a loop system where half of it will get tighter. So you kind of make sure it's all evenly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And then one finger should be able to go under pretty easily. It's unlikely with them, the way that harnesses go around their front legs, that they'll be able to really wiggle out of it.
Okay.
And I wonder about offering some tremendously tasty treat when you put it on at home, so to gradually get them accustomed, and maybe canned tuna or something that will distract them to the point of, okay, this isn't bothering me that much. But I did try a harness on my cats years ago, and they were only indoors, but just had one and wanted to see what they would do. And it was the exact same reaction of, now I'm paralyzed. But I do think if I persevered and kept putting it on, that they do get used to it over time.
Okay. Okay, it just depends on how much patience we have.
Yes.
All right, well, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. As a cat owner, Dr. Garrett, I imagine you I've heard from other cat owners that cats, more than dogs, cats own the home in which they live. And to that putting a leash or a harness on them, it's almost like saying, no, this personality inclination that you have, that you are in charge of this space, is not really true.
I wonder if they take it that way, although they seem to take everything that way. Cats are ultra sensitive on their skin and on the skin on their back. And I, around the same time as we tried the harness, we were cooking and had a spaghetti noodle fall off the counter and fell on the cat. And the cat started doing laps around the house. We could not catch the cat. She was panicked because there was this thing stuck to her fur. And it just triggers an innate, I have to get away, this is attacking me response. I think some of the harness may be more of an underlying, it's got me and I'm holding still, as opposed to this is undignified and I am the queen. And so in that way, they may get used to the sensation and not take it personally. And I do have several patients now who come in on harnesses. And one cat walks on that harness just like a dog. Just completely amazing and very, very content to be in the harness. So,
do you happen to know if it's a pet owner who also owns a dog and maybe the cat's reflecting some of the same behaviors?
That is a good question. I know she has several cats. This is the only cat that really does great on a harness. But I don't believe that he also lives with a dog.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we welcome your questions about pets and pet behavior, care and feeding, all of that. For veterinarians, Dr. Laura Garrett, Clinical Associate Professor of Oncology in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois, and Dr. Brendan McKiernan, Director of the Veterinary Teaching Hospital at the U of I. You can talk with Drs. Garrett and McKiernan at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email any questions you have to will-talk@illinois.edu. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. You could tweet us. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We're due to take a short break, and on the other side of it, we have an email question that has to do with the relationship between pet owners and veterinarians. So we'll talk about that after a short break. This is Focus.
Fontella Bass, who had this 1965 hit, died last week. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with her. Also, Frank Calabrese Jr. tells us about informing on his father, Frank Calabrese, a Chicago mob hitman who died in prison Christmas Day at the age of 75. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions on the care and feeding of your pets, from Fido's anxiety to Fluffy's hairballs to more serious circumstances, including pets dealing with cancer or dealing with the departure of another pet. We've been dealing with some of those issues this morning. We welcome your phone calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or again, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Ruth emails us and asks, do vets generally respect the decision to put down a pet with cancer or one which has been seriously injured rather than doing all possible to save the animal? And Ruth also asks, what can one say if the doctor presses the case for treatment? It's an interesting dynamic, and it's an interesting circumstance, and we were talking a little bit about it at the beginning of the hour, Dr. Garrett. What do you do when you're in that circumstance and you're thinking, well, this pet can be treated, and the pet owner is thinking, well, I think this is as far as we want to go?
Right. It's a very tough situation for everyone involved, and I think that's important for the veterinarians to, you know, try and see things from the client's perspective as well. And as I did mention earlier, it is always a reasonable decision to choose not to treat. And there are a multitude of reasons to not treat situations, including potential prognosis as well as cost, which is unfortunately a reality that many of the extreme injuries or cancer diseases are a costly proposition, and many people don't have health care for their pets. And so I know that as an oncologist, I try to be very understanding and upfront about here are the costs, and to put out there that it's okay not to treat, and that in some situations, not treating does mean considering euthanasia. So I think it's not okay to let a patient suffer, but it is okay to choose euthanasia really in any situation. That's one of the benefits that we have in veterinary medicine. As difficult as it is a way to make sure a pet doesn't suffer. And so it sounds to me from this question that there was a situation where perhaps this pet owner was feeling a bit of pressure, and that is unfortunate, and it does happen. Just because we're all emotionally involved in our jobs and we want to try and do the best we can, and so it may come across as a little bit of pressure of, oh, well, we can do this and this and this. And so it's very important to sit back as the professional and listen to the client's story and ask what their goals are and ask what sounds reasonable to them, and then respect those wishes.
Dr. McKiernan, I also imagine it might be helpful as you are identifying the veterinarian that will care for your pet in the first place to ask some of those questions when you have a new pet. How do you deal with these kinds of circumstances and see how they respond?
The important part of that question, Craig, is to ask questions about what am I going to do for my pet? I have a new puppy, but what happens down the road? What should I do in a year, 5 years? And when things are getting difficult, if there's a major accident or a major illness or cancer or something like that, how are we going to manage this? To talk and develop that relationship, that rapport. And in this instance, to ask, what are the other options? That those things are unaffordable, or I don't want to go that way, or I'm fearful of. Tell me a little bit more about what my options are and explain that. And hopefully we all provide those choices. Our concern is suffering and pain, controlling those things, being realistic about what the prognosis is. I tell people I have to be very blunt. I really enjoyed meeting you, knowing you, working with you for the years, but I have to really tell you this is where we are today, and these are the options, and you have the choice of where to go. But our number one concern is comfort and control of pain.
All right. So that's what you say. Let me ask the second part of her question again, which is what she could say, what the pet owner can say in the circumstance if the doctor is pressing the case for treatment.
It's difficult to sort of call attention to the elephant in the room. As a consumer, as a patient in a human hospital, or as the pet owner, I think to voice that concern and to say, you could do a reflective statement. So to say to the vet, it sounds like you're very interested in treating this, and I need to tell you that I'm feeling pressured right now. I don't feel like we're working as a team, and I'd like to work with you as a team. And this is really our job as vets. We should be saying this to the pet owners, but it's okay for the pet owner to sort of bring us back to reality. Whoa, you're going down that road. I don't want to go there. Can we step back and have a conversation about what I can do? And it is hard to do that. And it's actually one of the things that I'm also very involved in the curriculum is specific communication training of veterinary students and veterinarians. And circling back a little bit to, if we're in that situation where we feel like, boy, this conversation isn't going very well and this client just won't treat. And I think another aspect of what we can do other than just educating them about their options is to say, can I ask what your concerns are with this treatment? Because maybe I'm thinking, well, it's money, but the owner's actually reluctant to treat because of fear of side effects. And so then I can actually educate them in the area in which they need. So for this particular question, I would ask the owner back, can I ask what your thoughts are on this? And then if they tell me, I just don't think it's worth it because of the money, then I could say, okay, here's maybe some less expensive options, or absolutely euthanasia if that's what you feel is indicated. So it's a back and forth conversation.
Let's go next to Shirley in Mahomet. Hi, Shirley.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
One of my indoor cats has diarrhea, and his food has been the same. We give him cans of Friskies, and what can we do with that? Or what's causing it?
Lots of different potential causes, Shirley, for the diarrhea. How old is your cat?
Oh, I'd say he's maybe 10.
About 10, okay. So there are some other health issues that we'd worry about. So it's starting off with a general examination, physical exam, find out if there's any concerns. There can be absorptive issues. There can be parasites, bacterial components. The veterinarian that you're seeing probably would then take a stool sample. They might do a health panel that we talked about much earlier in the program, looking for underlying signs of underlying disease. I mentioned absorption of diet. Has there also been weight loss associated with the diarrhea?
No. Our two cats, Sammy, is very fat. My husband insists on having dry food down at all times and then feeding him the cans of Friskies twice a day.
Okay. Have you had your cat into a vet? Have you had a general exam?
No, I haven't. Okay. And I probably will not take him in. I'll just wait it out.
Okay. It's hard to say then what the cause is, because the treatments could be quite different for a parasitic disease versus an endocrine problem versus an absorptive problem, something affecting the intestines.
I have another question. My husband started throwing up and having diarrhea this morning. Could he have gotten it from the cat?
Very rare concerns in that regard, but there are some potential parasites that could be transmitted, but that's pretty unusual, pretty uncommon.
Okay. I suppose I should change the litter boxes then. Start out with fresh litter box so the other cat doesn't get it.
Again, that would be an assumption that this is a contagious problem, and we don't catch flu from our animals, and rare problems as far as diarrhea that might be contagious.
Okay.
But keeping the litter box clean regardless is always obviously a good idea.
We always do that.
Sure.
Yeah, I like the default position of change the litter box. Sure, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
You bet.
Next up is Stuart in Champaign. Hi, Stuart.
Oh, hi. I had a couple of questions. One is, this last fall, my cat came down with tularemia. And all we knew is that he was looking terrible. We went to visit a friend whose cat had tularemia recently. And we heard that there's an outbreak of it in this area, and that of the cats who had made it up to the U of I clinic, about half of them had died of it. Fortunately, he recovered, and my friend's cat did too. But I was just wondering how that was going, since that I was hearing about that a few months ago. The other question is about fleas. Our cats have fleas, and it seems as though the flea treatment we've been using is less effective than it had been. So that's it.
Okay. You're correct. There had been an outbreak of tularemia in the area, in the county here. Tularemia is a disease bacterial component that we associate with fleas from rabbits mostly, so the flea concern that you're mentioning could be connected here. It is a very severe disease, a very serious disease, and one that's hard to diagnose. One that is pretty rare, to be honest. I think we had 4 or 5 cases, Laura, during that period of time. It's, again, very serious disease, one that is contagious. We do have to take concerns, but it can be treated if caught early. Keeping your cat indoors, being aware of cats that are hunters, especially with rabbits. Cats are much more sensitive than dogs, for instance, so we don't have that same concern. I think there's only been one case of a dog ever with tularemia, but cats are much more sensitive and much more of a concern. The flea treatment, I'm not sure if you're using an over-the-counter product or have gotten something specifically from your veterinarian, but you may need to kind of ramp up your treatment options there if you haven't talked to a veterinarian about it.
We do get it for a veterinarian. We've been using Frontline. I know there are others available through the vet.
Yeah, flea resistance is a huge problem, and it the specialist will recommend cycling through different products. And again, with a cat, not all products are safe. So working with your vet to change those products, and then also treating the environment is crucial. And
crucial
again,
to treat the environment, right?
Your vet will have suggestions as far as carpets and bedding, and there are things that we can give to the pets that are safe to help decrease the flea reproduction as well as to kill them. So there's a number of products on the market. Changing them is important.
Good. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Dr. McKiernan, Lisa writes and asks, can atopical use in dogs cause hair loss? She says, 2 weeks into use and I've noticed a significant loss of her hair. She's not licking those areas to cause this. Any ideas?
Atopica?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cyclosporin, typically we use that for some of the dermatitis problems. So I would think that the underlying cause would need to be looking at as more likely responsible for what's going on.
Next up is Tom in Danville. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I have a question about cat food. I recently was adopted by a young cat.
Congratulations.
And I have had a number of people tell me all different things about cat food, so I went online to check it out and really found that there's a whole lot of controversy, it seems, about what a cat should and should not have. If a cat food, if it says on the bag it's 100% complete nutrition for adult cats, does that mean it's a good cat food, or are there better criteria to look for?
So there is a national organization that certifies food for cats and dogs, and I can't come up with the initials right now, but the pet food will say that it is such and such certified, and cat chow and meow mix, I mean, all of those sort of standard grocery store type foods are certified. And oftentimes what I tell my clients is pick just a well-known certified food.
Is this NSAR, National Service Animal Registry? Does that sound right?
No, that's
something else.
Yeah.
Okay,
There's an O in it for sure. And it's something that if your pet doesn't have any other specific health issues, you don't necessarily need a specifically formulated science diet for them.
Okay. What I have been feeding the cat is Meow Mix. One of my friends says, oh, it has all sorts of byproducts in it, and they're terrible for cats. And I thought, well, they eat mice, and they have a lot of byproducts. maybe they're used to that sort of thing.
There are some of the diets that have different concentrations of protein or carbohydrates. Some of them are more sugary, if you will. Cats, being carnivores originally, that do need a higher protein diet than, for instance, dogs do. So there is a question of protein content. If health issues do develop, then some of the Meow Mix or Friskies aren't the best foods that we typically would turn towards. But in general, as Laura was saying, if this is just a healthy cat, your standard major brand, name brand type of foods are going to be fine.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate your answer.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. And we'll You know, we're very short on time. I'm going to ask you one last question, an email from Alan that also deals with food and pets, and he simply asks to please talk about the dangers of chocolate and dogs.
Oh, so this is one of my favorite questions because it's not as serious of a toxicity as many people think. Chocolate has compound in it that can cause elevated heart rate and potentially cause arrhythmias in the heart. But this concentration is much higher in unsweetened or in dark chocolates than it is in milk chocolates. And so a dog can eat a lot of milk chocolate really without having problems, maybe some GI upset.
I think that would be the big thing, GI upsets, chocolate stains on your white carpet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so although one issue now is with the specialty chocolates going up with the 60%, 70%, 80% cocoa with people starting to like these dark chocolates, there may be more of that lying around the house. So the more you need to know what percent cocoa is in your chocolate. And for example, a 40-pound dog that eats an entire block of Baker's unsweetened chocolate, so that 8-ounce block, those dogs may actually get into a toxic level. But a handful of Hershey's Kisses will probably not do much more than maybe have them need to go outside more often.
Still not recommending that as major diet.
Oh, we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Laura Garrett's Clinical Associate Professor of Oncology in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois. Dr. Garrett, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Brendan McKiernan is Director of the Veterinary Teaching Hospital at the U of I. Dr. McKiernan, thank you for being with us as well.
Appreciate it, Craig. Thanks for everyone calling in.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On Monday's show, we will discuss political discourse in America with John Murphy, an associate professor of communication at the University of Illinois. Today's show is produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.